welcome. This is Why Life Is, and I'm your host, Niles McFlower. Yes, another great show tonight dealing with metaphysics, spirituality, science, and especially God's mind tonight. I thought it would be interesting to go into a subject that I frequently mention, but there's some esoteric realities I thought I'd talk about tonight. You may have heard of some of these, depending upon your background, Christian, Buddhist, that sort of thing. You would have heard some things that refer to some of the elements what I'm going to discuss tonight. If you're into a more religiously founded understanding, it's okay, fine. And most of this is really about how to be more virtuous and to live in a virtuous way without necessarily having it to be a moralistic kind of thing where somebody else is telling you how to do it. Or it is based upon, again, some specific belief structure. This is more, we'll call it the generalist and hidden way, hidden to those who are illusioned, and illusion just means it's kind of selfish. We're all selfish, so we're all in illusion to some degree. And the illusion prevents us from being able to understand some of the things that I will talk about tonight, so maybe we'll get around that. And that doesn't mean that necessarily, now, that whatever I'm going to tell you is definitely, without question, correct, but as usual, I say things as best as I understand them, and it's up to everybody to check that out to see if it works for them. Usually you can figure it out in your own life, and test it by coming up with, we'll say, a mental experiment. You don't even have to do anything. You can many times think of the past, and that will tell you some of the truth in your own mind. So for tonight, God's mind. What is God's mind? Well, you've heard me talk about it. It's three parts. What are those three parts? First two parts in most religions is referred to as spirit. What is spirit? Spirit is God's thought in its original capacity, or original thinking, or original, in our terminology, ideas, that are reflected in us trying to live in that way. And these particular, we'll call them thoughts, are different from the thoughts in general of most people in most things that aren't God, in the sense that God's thought always pertains to the improvement and we'll call it the prosperity of the growth of life, and that there being a balance to that kind of growth, which we're going to talk about today, and that further, that the thought, and I'll divide the thought up in a minute, is balanced out by action. So, in other words, just thinking good thoughts, which we could call godly thoughts, good, the word good comes from God, just thinking of good thoughts and then doing or not doing things that end in, we'll say, selfish or destructive to life, or we'll call it non-God, anti-God ideas, and prevention of goodness in general. If that's how a person lives in their life, then the results are that you don't end up with an outcome which comes from the mind of God, because the third part of God's mind involves action or activity. Some people prefer the word intelligent activity. The word intelligent means that less and less time and energy is expended in the process of being greater at greater levels of intelligence. Other people prefer the word love and wisdom together, the giving of wisdom, as part of activity. And that's another way of looking at it. There's so many different ways of explaining this in different traditions and different viewpoints, but they kind of all mean the same thing. which is very interesting, because despite the differences among people's views, the commonality of this and what the perspective of who or what God is, has a strong, we'll say, foundation in most monotheistic and some polytheistic religions and belief structures. So it's pretty amazing that you can have this tremendous dearth of variance in the kinds of ways that people can think about God and its mind, which I'm going to further define for you, don't worry about that, and still have a commonality. And I think that the secret to this has to do with tonight's show. So that's the esoteric or secret part. Now, let's talk about these first two parts that I said are spirit. They're broken into, as I said, two parts. And so there's really three parts to God's mind. And the first part has to do with purpose, creativity. These are all the same part. Called number one, freedom, choices, will. Will is the consistency of choice. A lot of words that in English are part of this whole big part of God's first part of its mind. And the first part is the first part of thought. Okay, but the second part of God's thought is taking the choices, taking the will, taking purpose, and adding to it a direction or a connectivity from one purpose to the next, a direction or connectivity from one element of being free to the next, a connection or connectivity of one choice to the next. And if the choices are connecting together, the very element of all the field of possible choices that we have becomes more and more limited. Why does it become limited, you would say? Well, because the more choices you make, the more you exclude other choices that you could have made. That's a simple way. What is that called? Well, it's really called quantum field theory. It doesn't matter. If you're not into mathematics, it really doesn't matter. But if you're into chaos theory, it makes a big difference because it eliminates the possibility of chaos as ruling the universe. But I'm not going to get into that tonight. But on a scientific level, that's why when people talk about the universe being just chaotic or random or strictly based upon a set of probabilities, strictly, then they run into trouble if they have a discussion with me about it, someone who understands something about more advanced elements of quantum physics, because it's not supported. It doesn't mathematically work out in a conceptual framework. It doesn't work either. So ultimately, when we really examine the big picture, it turns out that God does not have a plan, apparently, of the universe. The plan being the second part of how things connect together and have an effect on the first part of its thinking. It doesn't have a plan to make the universe just some random event and anything and everything goes, and you flip a coin and that's how things are going to happen. On the surface, it appears that way, because really, in quantum physics and other types of physics, it seems that that's a true statement until you get into this field aspect, where the more someone creates and the more that creativity is connected together with other things they're creating, and the more therefore there's a real plan to their creation, and the more there is consciousness and love, that's again the second part, those are other words that apply to the second part of spirit or God's thought, the result is that the very structure of what we think of as chaos is really just our limited ability to understand God's mind. If we could understand God's mind better without our own illusions, which are selfish, oftentimes egotistical and even arrogant, if we can eliminate that, be more open-minded, and be, let's say, not frustrated by the evils and tenacity of human beings in being destructive about God, because evil seeks to destroy God's growth. And how does it do that? Well, God's growth is life itself. God created life so that it could grow without controlling, mostly, the growth of life, by life having the first part of God's mind, freedom, and the second part, the ability to love, and eventually to love its own creator, if that life reaches the state of consciousness where the consciousness of God itself is possible. That's only possible that we know of in humans and anything more conscious than human beings. So animals don't have that, and when people say, well, we're just more advanced animals, no, we're not. We understand there is a God, at least some of us do, and the majority of people actually believe in the concepts I've already said. They believe in spirit, they believe in virtue, there's non-virtue, they believe, so a lot of people believe there's evil. But they see it from the perspective of an understanding that comes through two senses in their bodies, and those senses tell them that there is a God. Animals don't have a consciousness in those same senses, so they can't be conscious of God. They can only react to God in some way. So they can love each other, they can react to love, but they certainly don't go out and build any churches or other religious institutions, synagogues or whatever, mosques, and say, hey, God, we're here. We want to pray with you or pray to you or do something in here that involves you, God. No animals are doing that. We never have, to our knowledge. Yep. Now, I know dolphins are terrific beings. I love dolphins. They are terrific. And so are orangutans. But you won't find them on their own building or going to churches. Just don't do it. Do they have some awareness of God? Yes. Their awareness is not on a conscious level. They respond to love. They give love. They respond to other parts of God. But they don't understand God. They're not conscious of it. Okay, so we do, but we can have a choice. And in that choice, some people say, I'm forgetting about God. It's all things a bunch of nonsense. There's no God. Okay, well, we have that choice. That's freedom. That's freedom. The creator of the whole system said, in order for there to be real growth, there has to be freedom. And in order for that freedom to mean something, there has to be someone or something that is conscious of what the freedom entails. So if you're free to choose to either accept, reject, in between, agnostic, God, you can. You have that ability because God chose that in its own right as creating life, and especially human life. Pretty good idea. As a matter of fact, a fantastic idea. That it also means that the evil in the world, our world and many of us, is not caused by some being, God, who happens to be on the sidelines, sometimes rooting for the bad side. Someone suggested this to me this last week. I want to get together with this person and to talk about this, but at the time there was two limitations on our exchanges to be able to do that. And in that, what I heard was, well, there's a God, but it's one heck of a bad God because it goes both ways, and sometimes it just wants to screw everybody up because look at all the bad things. Well, that would mean that human beings are just puppets, and in this particular puppet show, sometimes God is on one side, sometimes on the other, and we just respond to what God chooses. That isn't what happens, of course. We are products of our own choices and our own selfishness and our own illusions, and the things that happen to us most of the time are chosen by us. Now, you might say, well, but what happens when a whole country? There's things that have to do with the response. responsibility we all have to the country and to the world. So in some very subtle ways, we're even responsible for that, but at not the same level all the time. All right, getting back to specifics. God's mind. All right, we got two parts. We got the first part. We got the second part. That makes spirit. Spirit, most of the time, in its pure elementally devised form, as it originally comes from God, is an enlightened source, meaning that it expresses God in what it is. But when spirit joins with the third part of God, which we call bodies or form or whatever, because intelligent activity also converts into, as many people realize, into form. Energy and form is what intelligent activity really becomes. In order for there to be action, there has to be energy, and there has to be form, and even what we call dense matter, you know, the things around us here in the physical world, those things are part of the third part of God's mind. And they allow us to interact. That's why it's called activity. It's involved with us. It allows us to interact with us. That's a good thing, because through life's interactions, there's a composite of mathematical possibilities, which is so great. It's far and wide greater than all of the non-interaction possibilities. If you just have one being and just said, well, here's all the things you can go play with or do something with. But now when you interact with others who are doing the same thing, oh, wow, that becomes a big deal. And just in this world, we know there's over 7 trillion humans, but if you can imagine other worlds that likely have at least similar numbers, if not more, this is a very big universe filled with just human beings in and of itself. Of course, they're not the only life form by any stretch. They're the first ones that can understand their own food. So God says, hey, okay, this is what I'm doing for you. I'm going to give you the whole ball game. You've got many, many choices, almost infinite, and you can do and choose as you want, and I won't prevent, in most circumstances, just about anything, including the rejection of God, including the rejection of and the act of destruction with evil to destroy God's growth or life itself. So ultimately, we have those choices. But at the same time, what limits us from God's side is God structures the universe in certain ways, so certain things become, by our standards, impossible. I'll just call it extremely, 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 extremely unlikely to happen. And so ultimately, in this particular kind of the world, where things are eventually limited by what we would call impossibilities, then it becomes something where there is an ultimate source of, we'll call it, decision that was made by the Creator or God's thought, that and its mind, because it also involves how that thought is taken into action. And those are, in many cases, what we call the laws of physics or other kinds of things that seem immutable to our efforts to change. However, let's realize that in many cases, it's our lack of wisdom and consciousness or understanding that leads us to believe some things that we could eventually have some ability to change. Does that mean that we can eventually become our creator? Yes, in some respects, that is that's an affirmative, but not as a human being. You see, human beings are limited to such an extent as a life form that we can't get around some of these quote-unquote laws, etc. But eventually, beyond the human realm, it's not only possible, if in some elements, in some parts of what we'll call esoteric teachings, it is possible for human beings to join with their creator and become, in many respects, almost all, one with their Creator. If that is possible, and it is true, then eventually, I'm not saying, you know, it's going to be tomorrow, we are all destined to this amazing place where the laws themselves become a, we'll say, stepping off point for our own creation. And that creation may remove us from the very universe we're talking about. So, and it does, according to a number of traditions. But the point is here that you can't be a human being anymore, because humans have way too many limitations on their senses, on the number of dimensions of time and space they have any sense of, and the lack of understanding of what they do sense. And so you can see this is a pretty severe problem for human beings. And that's what I'm discussing tonight. But be aware that even what I say is in a very confined fashion. And so there are other answers to the same questions, but you just have to move away from the human kingdom itself. Okay, so let's draw a picture of God's mind. Think of a circle, okay? Think of a circle. And let's divide the circle into three parts, okay? Three pieces, like three giant pieces of a pie, equally dividing the circles. That's pretty easy to picture, right? If you think about that, the point that intersects in the middle of the circle, and think of the circle as God's mind, okay? The part that intersects in the middle of the circle is referred to in a number of esoteric traditions as God's eye. Okay, what does that mean? In Buddhism, and Buddha expressing his own teaching, it's called the middle way. That little infinitely small dot where the three parts intersect in the middle of the circle. And sometimes the circle with the middle in it is referred to the completion of God's mind. It's referred to an ascended monad, if you know what that means, or just an ascended super being. And it, when someone is reaching into that kind of reality, that's just a symbol for it. Okay, the middle way. The middle way. Now, you didn't know that, probably. You probably never knew the middle way is the eye of God, which is the very center of the three parts of God's mind, equally balanced in perfection. And what does this eye do? I mean, eye is sort of like a, don't eyes look and see and that sort of thing? Yeah, now tonight's show I use quotation marks around the word eye because that is more, a little bit, I would call it, an analogy than it is a reality. But there is some reality to it. Let me tell you what the reality part is. It is through this part of God's mind that God can see any individual. Okay. That individual is like us. We're individuals, okay? God can see anything or anyone that is an individual, but it can't see all the little mosquitoes in the world. It can see the soul, which is called a group soul of the mosquito, because it has some individuality in itself, but the mosquito doesn't. So if God doesn't really see individual mosquitoes, it sees mosquitoes more as wholes through this center part of its mind. And God sees us more individually, because we are individuals, and we make individual choices and create individually. Yes, we can work together as a group. That's the second part of God's mind, but we still are individuals, and it can see us. Now, the big deal is this. When, at any particular time, that a person joins the first two parts of God's mind and becomes, we'll call it, good in their spirituality, creates goodness, not spirit that is engrossed in form and has lost God's thought, well, we bring it to a state where it is definitely a representation of God's thought. And then we take that into an activity or action that it relates or we'll say interrelates with others, and the level of interrelation balances or equals exactly what we're thinking, which is the same as God's thought. But what we're thinking adds some level of change or creativity to God. It has to, because the first part of it is freedom and creativity, purpose, etc. So when we do all these things, and if we do it right, we get it balanced, not only can God see us as an individual, but we can see God. The eye of God is a two-way eye. It's not just an eye looking at us. It's us looking at God at the same time. The more we hit the middle way, the more we go down the center, very center part of God's mind, the more we become a creative co-creator with our creator, with God, and the more we are being virtuous in our life. That's the point. Now, there's all kinds of quote-unquote, we'll quote, semi-mystical ways to follow the middle way, and therefore to find God's eye. But the interesting part about this is that those ways reflect more on older traditions that have little to do with a science and much more to do with a feeling, which is fine, a sense of feeling, and with a perspective of, we'll say, seeing results in others and in ourselves that reflects the middle way, reflects it. It is not a direct connection so much as a reflection in the older models of attempting to understand the middle way and to get there. Now, there's nothing wrong with that, except in today's world, most people are giving up this means of perception, this way of living, for a new way, nothing wrong with it, of developing a wisdom in their mental apparatus and in understanding truth by self and others' discovery of what truth is, and by recognizing, by tying together truth with wisdom, the giving of truth, that we can find a new kind of middle way that isn't so, I would call it astral, but isn't so based on how we and others feel as much as how we understand truth and exhibit it through wisely helping others to find it themselves in the ways that we give and create in a mental fashion, in a monastic way. Now, does this mean that this is like the greatest thing since sliced bread? No. It is only a stepping stone. The better way is even beyond that. It's called the Buddhic, not strangely, way, which is the ultimate way that we were supposed to get to anyway, which is something called controlled intuitional thought. It's a whole other thing. We'll get to it later in the show. But the point is that where we are right now, there's an interim period, and that interim period, I'm talking about in general for humanity on Earth, is that we're trying to find it through discovery of truth and then giving that to our fellow humans in ways that help them to do the same thing with the others, or the pay it forward thing. And that's a very good way at the present level of most people's development. They can't just suddenly become super beings developing a whole other new kind of senses and body called the intuitional or Buddhic body and live as a Buddhic being, because it's too big of a jump. So the middle way involves stepping stones, and the first it has to do with how we think mentally and what we do to it. Now, the counter to this, evil, has always has its little bag of tricks, is to create the opposite, to create non-truth, but not just not telling lies, but rather fashioning lies in a way that convinced people that they're wrong and those that are fashioning the lies for their own purposes are right. And that's called propaganda in some circles. And its purpose is to undo God's mind, to eliminate the middle way, and to close God's eye, both in being able, because God cannot see evil directly, just the way we can. It's hard for us to see evil. God cannot see evil directly. I know that sounds weird, but God's eye requires that there be light. And by his own, by its own choice, that's, but the point is that it's the choice of God to not see evil, because to see evil would be to limit it, and God chooses to allow evil the freedom to choose to fight against and not be part of everything it does do with God. And it's such a weird idea, isn't it? Everybody says, well, of course God can see evil. Oh, and unfortunately, this is not possible. If you've read, anybody who's read St. Augustine in Christian religion, that's what he believed. He believed that you couldn't see evil through only understanding God. Now, some people have really confused the St. Augustine elements, because he did have a checkered life before, you know, becoming a truly spiritual person. And in this checkered life, he followed many ways that convinced him that evil was protected by the freedom of God to do its own thing. And it also was protected because it made it invisible to those that were virtuous, but not yet wise. I'm kind of shortening what St. Augustine did, but it's pretty much what I just said. So the bottom line of this is pretty strange, even though it goes back to Christian teaching. It's way over the top in some forms of Buddhism. And it also is found in some elements of Islam. But the important thing to recognize here, and it's really strongly represented in Zoroastrianism, if you're familiar with that, which is kind of a Persian variant of religion. But the most important thing here is that when he came up with this idea, he came up with it experientially. He ingratiated himself with many people who are evil, he himself following many wicked ways, and he discovered something that was just amazing. The more dark he followed in some circles, the less those around him that were supposedly following a virtuous path could really see him and the bad things he was doing, and particularly those of his associates. And he wondered why this was the case. You know, certainly someone who is grossly evil, everybody should be able to say, that guy's evil. And he couldn't figure out what was going on until he did some real soul searching and discovered the principles that I'm suggesting here. So what does this mean? What does this mean? Well, in order for there to be true freedom, God can't even have its eye on evil. It can't, and so evil is in a place, literally. That place is sometimes called the A sphere in terms of a planetary situation. A certain planet has a part of its dimensionality where evil cannot be seen, even by God. Now, then how do evil people, or how do people who aren't evil find evil? I mean, you would think it's like, oh, well, that closes everything off from everybody. Well, you don't find evil by choosing to be evil. You find evil by choosing to hate and wanting to destroy God. It's a very bizarre kind of thing. When you do that, you close the eye of God. So you're no longer recognized as being an individual, and you yourself no longer recognize yourself as an individual, but identify yourself with the concept, you say, of wanting to destroy a God that you don't like in some ways, and those who are quote-unquote good because you don't like some elements of what they're doing in their goodness or their lack of goodness in relative terms. So this is a rejection. And in that process of rejection, the results are kind of disaster, because when a person no longer sees himself truly as an individual, there's a thing called the group soul of evil. What the heck is that thing? Well, it is a soul of nature, but it's a soul that has the complete rejection of God's ability to both see it, recognize it, and to stop it. It doesn't truly believe that God doesn't exist. It just doesn't care to let others know that, and to let others know that God does exist, and it tries to promote the opposite. And it, at the same time, wants to destroy God. So it's a kind of a frustrated, angry being. And once a person associates himself with the group soul of evil, then they are insulted by this instead of their own soul, and they actually distance themselves from their soul for maybe more than one lifetime, and then eventually destroy that connection. Not good. Not a good idea. But it happens. And that's how someone gets into the evil club. You don't get there by following the evil path. You know, instead of the yellow brick road, you follow the hideous colored road or something. There's no such real thing as that. It's just this frustration and rejection, and eventually this process. It also involves the third part of God's mind. The person has to take actions. Can't just think this. It must take actions that separates the three parts of God's mind, so that it isn't that it closes the eye in the sense of eliminating it that way. It actually tears it apart. The mind becomes more like an animal's mind, which is not really integrated enough together to be able to create the mind of God and to be seen as an individual. So they're replicating a process that goes backwards in evolutionary stages. There's more to it than that, but I'm not allowed to talk about it, because certainly I don't want to give you the complete recipe for becoming evil. That would be kind of nuts, right? Okay, so this is as far as I could take it. But and even if I could go further, again, no guarantee that I would be right about that. But at any rate, getting to the crux of the situation, evil is the opposite of God. And in its opposition, it also separates God's mind. Separates. It doesn't squish it together and make something go weird with the middle. It actually eliminates the middle, so to speak. And that's the way it manages to be destructive. Now, can evil actually destroy God? That's a whole other thing that I will talk about when we come back from break. But it is imperative at this point to recognize that everything I'm explaining in this first beginning section has a lot of other, we'll say, practical value issues, which we're going to cover for the whole rest of the show. So don't go away, even though this part has been very, very, we'll say, conceptual. Okay, we will be back to further go over this in about 2.5 minutes from right now.
Hi, everyone. Since childhood, I've had questions about my life and life in general that I couldn't find adequate answers to. Questions like, why am I here? Why are others here? Does the universe have a purpose? And how does that relate to my life? More recently, I've been wondering what happens when we die, especially the reasons why. I'm more of a doubter than a believer in many things, and answers that include the whys allow me to think and figure out the truth for myself. I've been reading a book, Life's Hidden Meaning. This one book contains more answers, including the whys, than all other sources I've read or heard. It's amazing to me that every one of my questions has been thoroughly answered. More importantly, I have found that all of these answers so far have checked out to be true. I hope this message helps some of you in your quest for better understanding. The name of this wonderful book is, again, Life's Hidden Meaning by metaphysician Niles McFlower. Some bookstores sell it. I got my copy directly from the publisher at agelesswisdom.com. Life's Hidden Meaning may enlighten your mind and bring some peace and joy to your heart.
Hun, what book are you reading?
It's a novel, kind of, about romance, love, and spiritual life in general.
Kind of a novel? What do you mean?
Well, it's based on some real-life experiences and even real characters. Some of their experiences are fascinating and remarkable. I can't put this book down.
How come the title is Afterlife Love?
That's part of the fascination. This book describes the afterlife in intricate detail and even explains why things are the way they're explained.
But how can anyone write about or know that?
Some of the characters travel out of body to some places that people who've already died also go to. I'm finding it completely believable because it all makes sense and fits into a bigger picture for me.
Hun, what happens to these people?
You can read it for yourself when I'm done if you want.
Better yet, I'll get my own copy so we can discuss it while we read. Let me see. I'll write down the title. It's Afterlife Love by Niles McFlower. McFlower.
Afterlife Love is available in some bookstores and from the publisher at agelesswisdom.com. Or 480-966-3132. That's 480-966-3132.
We're back. This is Why Life Is, and I'm your host, Niles McFlower. Yes. And tonight's show is God's Mind, Middle Way, and I. Okay, so hopefully you did hear the first part of the show, but if you didn't, welcome anyway, and we're going to continue going into this subject. So to start with what I stopped with, we shouldn't be so concerned that God has permitted evil to exist, because this is a challenge. Remember that just because you're good doesn't give you the ability, if we believe Saint Augustine, to be able to understand and even more importantly perceive evil. As a matter of fact, if the only thing we did in a lifetime was to be virtuous, we might be as blind to evil as, I said, God chooses to be. Now, this is a strange thing, and I want to explain how you come around or deal with this enigma. Because one, it would seem like, well, what if you're born just really angelic and everything else, and you can't figure out evil from the heads up or down to tail, and you get, you know, you're physically alive and terrible things happen and you don't even get it. Well, this happens all the time. And the answer, unfortunately, is to become a victim of the outrageous actions of evil if you're doing a lot of virtuous things and not doing much evil yourself. And you're like, what kind of deal is that? Is this my reward? And that's the whole point. No, it isn't a reward. Sometimes part of action or activity means that you have got to deal with forces. And just because someone is really, really good doesn't mean that they don't understand how to deal with forces. And part of the experience of coming to the physical world that we have right now, for human beings, especially, is to gain an understanding of force. Now, there's good things about forces to some extent. I mean, they actually have some benefits. They provide most of what we call evolutionary development. And without there being forces, a lot of the development of life would just have to become, unfortunately, a predetermined factor by something, which we would think would be God or otherwise, it wouldn't really matter. But the forces allow that question to be resolved without there being a lack of freedom. The same element of forces is used by evil to subject and eventually be destructive to God. How do you get around that? Now, this is going to be controversial, and I know that I'm going to say some things that I'll get some emails about, I think I do. And that is this. We have to become wiser as human beings, and recognize that evolution and a lot of major parts of science are part of God's plan. And not some kind of conspiracy that lefties or somebody, you know, came up with to frustrate conservative people or whatever, or religious people. No, it's that, in effect, science has a major role to play, and part of science is the understanding of forces, and forces are a major part of evolution up to, but not including, the development of humanity. This is why it's so strange. If a human being were to go through an entire lifetime and just be, I guess you'd call them goody-two-shoes, but they would be just so angelic that they did nothing but create goodness, and if there were no evil, they would never learn about forces. They would reject the concept of certain parts of evolution because to them it wouldn't even exist. And they'd be ignorant of the understanding of force. So evil helps, in a weird way, the ignorant parts of humanity, which may still be very good but ignorant of force, to understand that there are forces by the unfortunate use of force against some good people, who can't recognize or understand evil, and that's how evil can use it against them. They become victims. And they become animalistic. And they bring that human, or those humans, into a world of animalistic behaviors, where survival of the fittest, and, you know, that sort of thing, becomes an imperative. And they are forced to use force to stay alive in some respects. And so that's how evil helps those that are good but ignorant of evil to understand evil and to find wise ways of using forces so that evil is eventually tripped up in its own realm and can't, in many cases, enter into the realm of the good that are wise. That's called closing the door to evil. You can close the door only if you're wise, effective in the use of force in the physical world, and in the next world or astral world, you can't use force. You're prohibited from using force. You have to understand both of those things by being wise in your mental thinking. And if you are, then you understand the process and you use it accordingly. And so this is a fascinating thing. And why can't you use it in the astral or the monastic world? Because you can't force people to feel or think anything or you yourself become evil. But you can stop people from acting in a physical sense, in a destructive way to you and others that are doing good. As a matter of fact, you not only can, you're supposed to. And understanding that principle is a whole other stuff. Because then you get into the question of conscientious objectors. And people say, I won't fight because it's wrong to kill. That's an interesting point. If you understood what I just said, most of the time, when faced with evil, the right thing to do is to fight. sometimes resulting in death to evil things in people. But it's a terrible problem, and it's not easily decided, because sometimes you have to make sure you're fighting for God and not for just some, you know, I'm fighting because this ruler or that person said I should fight. So this is the kind of thing that, where you get into all of these, which we're going to talk about tonight, we get into all these areas of life, and it's confusing as all get out. And you become like this a friend of mine who said, well, you know, God can't be a very good being because look at all the crap that's going on. And I said, well, you know, you have a deeper understanding, you know. But I couldn't go into it. Okay. So how do we follow through then with these relatively advanced concepts? I mean, this is not simple stuff. I'm not kidding when I talk about this stuff in, well, esoteric, meaning hidden, because for the most part, most people, you know, these are questions they don't have answers for in life. And they would like the answers, but they don't want to just be told, like, why is it so? Because the Bible tells me so. But they don't want to hear that. Most people today don't want to hear that. I mean, there are some that still go along with that. It's fine. Sometimes the Bible says things that actually are very true, depending upon what Bible you're talking about. But there are no concept. Now, why is it true? It's the point that's really going to enlighten people these days. So without the why, it really doesn't make much sense. You could say, okay, I'll buy it because, you know, the Bible told me so. Jesus said it, so it must be true. Of course, the person who says that Jesus said it was born 50 years after Jesus died, didn't what? Well, you know, that can be true. That can be, you know, read Mark. Okay, so you get into all this stuff, and you start realizing that there is a reason, a rational, completely understandable reason for what's happening. It's not some kind of just throw the dice and what the heck and anything can happen and that's it. No, it's nothing like that. Anything that is possible can and will eventually happen. But there are many things that are impossible. And that's where people don't understand physics or quantum. They misunderstand that, and they say, well, physics says anything's possible. No, lots of things are impossible, but that phrase has been changed wrongly, actually by the dark side, to convince us of a chaotic universe. Because if you can convince people that God doesn't exist, which evil does not believe, not the head honchos, but if you could convince people that it is true, you got a lot better chance of turning them evil, and you're certainly having a much easier time in destroying them. Because even though the eye of God doesn't help us to see evil, it does help us to gain a sense or a responsiveness. And it's through the forces that are brought upon us. Those forces may be rules and restrictions that prevent us from creating and having freedom in a certain way. It may be the result of preventing us from being educated in ways so we can understand much. It may be in false education. It may be in all the elements of propaganda I was talking about. It may be in abuses of the power and control of the majority. It may be in a restriction or the ability to prevent minority from having a voice at all, or much of them. So you can see all these things are forces that we need to become fully aware of and then consciously able to deal with. If you can accept what I'm saying, then the rest of the show, as far as how you can make your life a way better way of living, will start making a lot more sense. You see, there's a foundation, and that foundation is exactly what I'm talking about in this first part of the show. And the thing that really I find remarkable is that there is an ultimate end in the process. It is not just some kind of like, oh, well, we'll kind of bump along here and go nowhere. The ultimate end is one of two things. Either the forces become so destructive to life, and particularly human life, that that the majority of people for a fairly protracted period of time do not either succumb to the forces or are oblivious to them. And when that takes place, you end up with some really, really bad outcomes. Now, the bad outcomes are almost always connected to a specific place. In this case, we call it Earth. And it's limited by, again, the laws of God. God says that light will limit the ability for the good to transfer their lack of wisdom across the universe. Well, that makes sense. You know, if you're not enlightened, you're not going to get very far. And it's actually in a physical sense that way. Evil doesn't work that way. Evil can traverse the entire universe instantly, almost, with going millions, billions of times faster than the speed of light. So you have a totally different system. I'm not allowed to talk about that too much. But the point is that the processes are so antithetical to each other that when a planet, a specific planet, is going too far in the results of force and lack of awareness of it, so it's becoming darker and darker, and it's really in a, we'll call it a spiral towards destruction, it is almost instantly cut off from being able to contaminate any other world. Now, remember, the contamination wouldn't be by evil. It would be by the ignorance of the good. The ignorance of the good. So that's what you have to worry about. You don't have to worry about evil so much, because evil can go anywhere, anytime. That's not really its issue. It's the good that are ignorant that are the danger. And are there a majority of those here on Earth? We're getting pretty close. And so this is a serious measurement that we can use. And how do you know when that point is reached? Well, when evil is facing, on a large scale, a whole mass of people, like here in the United States, where I'm talking from, I believe we're facing some of that right now. But we don't see it. We're ignorant. Okay? If we're ignorant to the evil, then that's a bad thing, because we're leading the leading country in the world, and that will have a cascading effect on most of the people. The results can be very devastating. We look at Egypt as it is right now, Libya, Syria, and all. And there seems to be a lot of bad things going on, and they're not unrelated. Okay, so, and it's force. Yeah, what is force? Force is someone saying, I am now your dictator. You will do as I say, or I will torture and kill you. And a lot of people say, oh. And a lot of other people might say, well, there's got to be a redeeming factor in that person, because after all, he's a member of this or that organization, and that's not a bad thing, right? Okay. And if you buy that, I've got some swampland to talk about. Yeah. How about the Brooklyn Bridge? Would you like to buy that? Okay, so there's a lot of things that are misquoted, misunderstood, illusions, that are happening right now. And when you see a majority of people going along with it or just not even paying attention to it, then you've got the setup for what I'm talking about. Now, it's going to happen tomorrow or December 21st. I don't think so. But in the next year or two, yeah. In the next 10 years, real scary. So we've got some serious problems, and we're not looking at them. and things could go real bad, real fast. Is this a time, then, for all of us to be, like, running away or looking for some way out? No. This is a time to stand up to the forces and to deal with them, even if it means the destruction of individuals, to recognize that life is a continuum. We will go on living in another dimension, time and space, some people will call it heaven or whatever they want to call it. And what we're here for at this time is this particular experience. And we will be back, although many people don't believe in reincarnation, but we will be back. And the thing is that it is not meant as a punishment. This is actually a unique experience. Only the good parts get to our soul, because the eye of God is the eye of the soul, too. And that eye has a pinpoint in the middle of it. And it has many sections to it, 96. And those individual sections are the division of how different parts of God's mind are represented in a monastic aspect. Too complicated to talk about. But the important thing is the soul is like, our soul is like a miniature of God's mind. And we are the actors in this dimension. It is not. So it sends its third part of its mind, at us, to the lower dimensions, where we're in the lowest right now. And this is what we're supposed to be doing. Learn about forces, deal with evil, find ways of overcoming it, and ways of standing up to it, but most importantly, be aware of it. If you don't sense it, you can't be conscious of it, and there's nothing you can do about it. Believe me. Those are truisms. Okay. Anyway, I'm going to give us all a little bit of a rest, because, you know, it's about 8 o'clock here in my time zone. You probably have a different one. And this is where I usually stop, and sometimes at some shows, and I talk about something else. Tonight I'm going to talk about my experience this afternoon, actually, with a fellow named Patrick Burress. I hope I'm pronouncing his name correctly. Mr. Awesome. He's learning humility, so he gave himself a goofy name. Mr. Awesome. All right. Patrick is a very nice fellow. He works for a place called Active Forever. Active Forever? What's that? Well, it's a place where you could go if you have any kind of a physical issue going on in your life that is preventing you from living a more normal life. And they come up with ideas and plans and ways of living a more normal life. Pretty cool place. Yeah, in the sense that some people go there and they just hang out and look for ways of doing that. It's a good way. He helps people to do that. And he is... He works at their Scottsdale showroom. They have like different showrooms. They also have one in Peoria, another part around the Phoenix metropolitan area. And they have one, I think, in Mesa. So these areas, these stores, we'll call them, really also are connected through a website, and you can get to that. And I'll tell you how to do that. But also, you can call Patrick, and you can talk to him about what your needs are. And no matter what they are, you know, he might be able to figure out some way of helping you out. That is pretty much what he does. In addition, he today helped in a very practical way. I wanted to buy some cushions I can sit on. Sometimes I have to sit for very long periods of time. I do this show and other things. And find something I can sit on that's relatively soft, but also creates good ergonomic stuff. I was looking for that today at his particular store. And he was helping out in a number of ways. One of them was to even find the one that I wanted, which was very, very popular and naturally sold out. But we managed to find a solution to that. And he actually actively spent about a half an hour working on this. And so that was good, and I appreciated that. And I told him tonight I'd talk about this experience that he gave. And if you need his help, or those of others that work with him, if he's busy, you can call him at 480-767-6600. Now, what if y'all live outside of the Phoenix area and you still live somewhere in the States? You can call 800-377-8033. I think that's the right number. Let me check that out. That is the correct number. I had to make sure. Okay, so that's the number, and it's extension 132. You dial that 801 number. So if you're outside of the area, they can still ship stuff to you. They may not. The thing that I like about going to one of these places is you're pretty hard to look at a picture of something and know what it feels like when you sit at it. I mean, just being practical, right? So a lot of this stuff is like show and tell. You've got to go test it out, feel it, and, you know, whatever. And, you know, it's not really just a mental operation. But in either case, if that's not possible for you, you can check that out. And you can go to their website, activeforever.com, activeforever.com, and look at all the stuff that they have. It's quite extensive. They even have motor vehicles and weird stuff people can use to get around on that are different than what you normally see on television or someplace like that being advertised. It is a fascinating place to go if you need any kind of assistance or you know somebody else who does, because many times, you know, it isn't just us we're concerned with. And I'll tell you, the solution for me was $23.40 plus tax. So it wasn't a lot of money, but it was a pretty good experience overall. All right, so give him a call, Patrick Barrett. And it's a young fellow who, I don't know if he's listening tonight, but I told him I was going to talk about him. And so give him a call and see if he is going to be of some assistance, or if he's not, like I said, if he's not available, certainly somebody else there could be of some help. Okay, Active Forever, and that's enough for that. We'll come back to activity, since we're talking about activities, and discuss the question of intelligence. Intelligent activity reduces the amount of time it takes and energy it takes to do any active action. So the more intelligent it is, the more less it takes to do something in terms of energy and time. Now, compressed energy and time is money, so interestingly, you use up your money less if you're using intelligent actions. God is seeking there to be a balance between freedom, I'm using short circuit things here, freedom and love or consciousness together with a balance of intelligent activity. If you get them balanced, you're on the road, the middle way, to being a part and a co-creator with God. This is such a tremendous experience. Let me tell you in a sensation way what it feels like. When you first start doing this, if you hit the middle way, the feeling will be one of joy. Now, joy is different than being happy. Happiness is usually connected with a lack of force. So is, in some circumstances, excitement. Okay. Excitement is the perception in your astral nature or your emotional nature of having no restrictions on you for the moment. Oh, I'm free, I feel free for the moment. That's excitement. And, like, you can do things that you couldn't do prior to the excitement, whatever that might be. And so that's a good way to understand that. And then if we look at happiness, happiness is the ability to have and use material things. excitement at once. So that's what people call happiness. The interesting thing is the original concepts in the founders of the United States was, instead of happiness, the pursuit of happiness, it was the pursuit of material things or property. And they changed it to happiness because happiness had a wider understanding, wasn't so narrow about property, and it led to more universal truth. And yet that means they understood what I just explained to you, which is a big concept. So they were really wise folks because they actually changed it from the word property to happiness. Okay. Now, why is happiness that usually part of the wisdom that I'm talking about, which is usually referred to as ageless wisdom? And that's because it's transient. So you could be happy one minute, unhappy the next, because you lose the qualities of the material world or the ability to control them, which means you feel insecure and that kind of stuff. With joy, no such thing. Joy is not a state of happiness. Joy is the state of inner elation, okay, different than excitement. And what is the difference? Because the elation is that you have experienced a part, a small part sometimes, of God by serving or being of spiritual help to others. And you see it or experience it in some way. It could be, there's obviously virtually an infinite way. But the point is that this is joy. Joy is a great thing, way better than happiness. If you get joy, happiness becomes just like it's off the radar screen. You don't even think about it anymore because you're not in illusion. You're out of the illusion, becoming enlightened, let's say, with God's own thought and actions. And you're in the middle way. That's joy. Okay. Now, joy, when it becomes consistent, means that, and you can control it to some extent. When you can consistently control the activity of being in a joyful state, okay, because of your service to others, spiritual service to others, then you are not only have you found the middle way, but you have managed to, in a conscious, controlled fashion, stay on it. You truly have opened the eye of God. You can see God. God can see you. You as an individual exist in God's mind. God exists in your mind and in your soul, so to speak, as an individual as well. And both are part of the whole. So you're becoming a greater individual while you're becoming more one with everyone else. That is doing the same thing now. No, you're not becoming more one with people who want to go do terrible things. You're becoming more one with those who have enough wisdom and enough of the spiritual disciplines, etc., to create this kind of life. And then you have consistent joy, which is called, there's another word for it, called bliss. Bliss is joy done in a consistent way, and you're in the middle way for a protracted period of time at a time, not all the time, and you can do so on a controlled basis by your own choosing when it is appropriate in your serving others. It could be teaching, maybe as I am doing, or it could be many, many other activities. But whatever they may be, you're creating this, and this state of inner elation is one of becoming more a part of our own creator and co-creator. It isn't like God's creating in place of us or we're creating in place of God. We're doing it together. When I say God, remember, that's the collective good of all that are doing it. And literally, this controlled intuition means that. It means that you're connected to a thing called omniscience with all others at a minimum. Eventually, it leads to omnipotence and other kinds of connections, but at the beginning, it's just. Omniscience are all-knowingness. All that means is you know all you need to know to be wise in your spiritual service. It doesn't mean you know everything. No, you're not going to go on Jeopardy and win every round. you're going to be of spiritual service to those that need that, and in ways that are, at all times, at least wise. If not, there's other ways besides that, but at least wise, and that help them to become wise givers themselves. Helping them to do that doesn't mean that you force them, and doesn't mean that you're always perfect. It just means that you're in the middle way, which means that that part of you is in a state of becoming greater and greater. Well, if you're becoming greater and greater, then you can't be perfect, right? If you are perfect, there's no place to grow to, and there is no such thing as perfection, because every element of God is growing in itself, and therefore is growing from all those that are co-creating with it. And so it's growing faster than anything, and it is not a perfect being. God's not a perfect being? That's right. The middle way is not a perfect one. It's a way of being a part of creation in the Creator. And that part has no end to growth. Therefore, it's never perfect. Hard to understand these concepts, I know. And so when we have an imperfect being who creates a universe of further imperfect beings, okay, got it, what does that mean? Well, it means that imperfection is not a, we'll call it, evil. Imperfection is a state of creation. And perfection would be the end of that state of creation and would be an imperfect state in terms of what the Creator has chosen to be its own realm. I know this is hard to understand. This is not like, oh, geez, is it all double talk or something? No, it's just you got to put yourself in a place where you open your mind to something that sounds a little strange. And it even sounds contradictory until, that's called a paradox, by the way, until you can join these opposites together and see the bigger truth. And literally, the middle way, according to Buddhic understanding, is to literally do what I just said, to find truth by seeing how the opposites are truly not that, but there is a other way of seeing things that look like they're opposite. It's only our ignorance and selfishness, illusion, that prevents us from seeing it. And therefore, that when people say, I want to be perfect, or God is perfect, and therefore to be godly, I have to be perfect, they're making a huge mistake. Now, let's talk about that mistake, because it is the mistake that evil oftentimes uses and also originates from. If we look at most of the stories, especially in Christian lore, but also in some other religions, most of the darkness that eventually becomes evil comes from a rejection of an imperfect God and an imperfect realm of goodness. And then a rejection of self, so that you are willing to accept this group soul kind of thing, and to become a destroyer rather than a creator of life and God. So part of the beginning of the process, the genesis of evil, comes from the misperception that there is such a thing as perfection, and God itself must be that. So to know and be God, or be one with God, or to be loved by God, or to be liked by God, is to know what perfection is and to exercise it in whatever ways you are told to do so, in a very deterministic religious fashion or a very deterministic philosophical world. Either way, the ontological viewpoint that represents leads a person into darkness and evil. There can never be perfection because all growth ceases. And growth is the will of both the creator of this universe and any or all others as far as we understand them. So the ultimate aspect of God is that it only doesn't seek perfection. Its model is based upon an unachievable factor in perfection, that growth can only occur through there never being the achieving of perfection. Therefore, God is imperfect. But in its imperfection, it provides us with the most important thing, that's life and growth. There would be no reason for life, and no, because everything would become deterministic, and no way to grow in a perfect, guided universe. Wow. This is tough for us to understand. And most religions state this exactly the opposite, usually because of the follies of human beings, in trying to use God as a deterministic being to control people in a political sense. Sometimes for good reasons, but with bad outcomes. This is not the God that I am telling you about. This is the God that is oftentimes promoted because humans have used it as a power play, and sometimes it's become very much evil. But even when it's not evil, it is a forceful power play to try to control and intimidate and change the minds and thoughts of people, to steal from them their right to be free thinkers and co-creators themselves. Tough one to consider. And for some people, they're probably turning you off right now because, well, this is what Preacher Blank Blank says. Yeah, if you're very religious and your religion is telling you the opposite of what I'm saying, I don't blame you if you don't, you know, agree with me. The point is to think about it from the standpoints that I'm explaining it and realize this isn't a bad thing. It's a pretty good thing. It's a very good thing. You just got to look deeper into the concept and recognize what it really means. It's the why everything is the way it is. And it explains things that are inexplicable in a universe where there's a perfect God and everything in it's expected to be like God in some perfect way. And that universe is not the one we're in, and that universe we couldn't exist in. As a matter of fact, nothing that had any freedom of choice could exist in that universe. You have it would quickly come to an end because determinism does that. Now, let me explain something. Evil uses determinism in a very, very sly way. Evil uses it by making people insecure through the use of force on them and forces them to, by restriction of thought and rules that are placed upon them, into a universe, so to speak, usually it's a country or a state or whatever, in which they are dictatorially removed from most freedoms. Once that takes place, and that's what's happening right here in the United States, it's going on in other places, once that happens, the results are inevitable. There is no way around it. It is determinism, and it is anti-God. It's evil. Right? Now, if you can see that what I'm talking about, I don't care what political persuasion you are. I'm talking about this in a bigger concept way. If you can see it, you're getting closer to the middle way. You and God are getting cozy together. I've said this in a much earlier show about 6 months ago, but I can explain it to the level I am today because we didn't have time. I mean, just to talk about this one concept is going to take the whole show, so I had to kind of gloss over it. But this is really the crux of what was going on. Some people say, well, how come you talk about Ayn Rand sometimes? Some woman from the 30s, 40s, and 50s who wrote weird books that are 1,000 pages long. Because she saw it and tried to explain it in her storytelling. Now, you could call lot of things. What I call it is a spiritual truth applied to a fictional way of seeing a future that wasn't so fictional. She lived through it in the Soviet Union and saw the outcome. So she was able to see it clearly enough to recreate it in a future sense as it would take place here in the United States. And most of what she wrote is coming true at the very moment I'm speaking. So it's a really interesting thing. And if we're going to get anywhere along the middle way together, we need to be much more aware of what it is we're involved with so that we don't get lost. Now, I'll tell you something. The majority of the leaders, quote-unquote, in a political sense here in the United States, are lost. Republicans, Democrats, some of them independents, others libertarians. Why are they lost? Because despite the fact that they don't like, for one reason or another, some of the things that are going on, they can't see it as what it really is. It's just evil all over again. Propaganda, lies of the other day, or every day, and nobody recognizing what's going on. Well, there's a few. I mean, a guy named Glenn Beck was talking about things that are happening today, 2, 3, 4 years ago. How did he manage to do that? Go watch his old shows. How did he do that? Well, because he was able to see the truth, apply wisdom, and he was able to predict accurately almost everything that's been happening. I think it's fascinating. Now, that doesn't mean that he walks on water or something. He made a lot of mistakes, especially in the last year. But the point is that the bottom line here is that the ability to be aware of what is the anti-God is more important than having a particular, you know, I'm in the Tea Party guy or something. All that stuff is a surface issue. It's not going to give us the real answers. You can't bargain with evil. You'll never find a solution with evil to any problem. You can't come to a compromise. There's no answers. There's no political answers. There's no military answers. A lot of people say, well, why can't you just all get up and rebel? Well, all getting up the streets and civil war, this or whatever. That isn't the answer. The answer is become aware and become conscious and then take actions that show wisdom. When you do those three things, you can defeat the worst kinds of evil very quickly. I'm not talking about years and years. I'm talking about weeks. Maybe 2 months. It just requires more people to wake up than we've got right now. Okay, so the leaders aren't in that position, and that's our problem. We've got too few leaders that have the awareness. And then the few that have awareness, their consciousness is not good enough. And then the ones that have that, aren't willing, they don't have a backbone to take the actions that are necessary because it usually requires sacrifice, and usually it's a personal sacrifice of their own position, authority, and image. Yep, it is. It's transient. It may only be weeks or months of time that they have that, but they don't know that. And they think, well, my life is over. I won't be a senator. I won't be a congressperson. I won't be this or that anymore. Well, why? That were true, but it's usually not the truth. See, this is where our issues are. Now, I'm going to take this down to a more quote-unquote individual personal level. I'm talking about leaders this time. What about the rest of us? Well, the rest of us are kind of like on our own. If the leaders are all screwed up, we're really in trouble, and we all need to become more aware and then more conscious and then take action. The action should not be wanton violence or some kind of, we'll call it rebelliousness. It rather needs to be more calculating and wise. And it also needs to stay in the middle way. Now, the middle way means that the things that are done continually grows enlightenment in others. You don't take any action if it doesn't do that. Now, you can say, wait a second. The evil people aren't going to be enlightened. That's right. You don't pay attention to them. You pay attention to those that can be enlightened and have them. There are many more of them, and you can really get to them. Don't worry about the evil ones. They're not the problem. Honestly, the problem is in those who want to do good, are trying to do good, but are ignorant and unaware and cannot see evil, period. They have no clue. If you get to that level, you can do some amazing things. Now, what does it mean, leading your personal life that way? Well, I'm not saying everybody goes out and joins some party or does something like that. I'm saying this is on a daily interactual mode with everybody you meet. It's incumbent upon those who can understand to help those who can't in every way possible. Growing consciousness is not getting on a soapbox and talking about a specific political event or issue. It's really about helping people to overcome the tendency for selfishness and for illusion or for not using what their senses are there for. Instead, they get misinformation, they create poor knowledge, bad knowledge, and then they use it in ways that are purely material self-interest. That's what we're contending with, and we can deal with that. Everyone that's listening to me can be doing this. The ways are the creations that will change who you are. Every one of those creations, though, will open new doors and will allow evil to see you more. So be aware that if you don't continue down the path of creation, once you have the awareness, you will become a target and a pretty bad one, and you may get completely destroyed if you are not also creating and being wise in your giving and doing it in a way that takes this to an active level. You've really got to do all this together. The middle way requires it. Some people say, well, I really did most of what you said. I meditated and I thought and I changed a few things in my life. I just wasn't as active and I wasn't as creative as you said. What's wrong with that? Well, what happened? Terrible things. This person came and robbed me. That person did something else bad to me. Or this group came after being stopped. Why? Why me? Well, look at the middle way. You didn't choose the middle. You opened the door, but you didn't create the problem. You didn't co-create. And you're not in the eye of God. And the answer would be very simple. Usually I ask people, well, how joyful are you? And they say, joy? How can you be joyful in this moment? Okay. There you go. You get your answer as soon as you ask yourself that question. Because if you're not experiencing joy, you have really gone down the path in the wrong way. Truly. It's a difficult thing. No matter how much you may be spiritually serving, a joyless life says you're making a mistake. And correcting it is really your job. A lot of people say, well, I pray to God to help me correct that. Remember, if you're not in the eye of God, prayers don't help you. You can only pray to help others. That's what prayers are good for. And even then, you still have to be in God's eye because you can't be seen or heard unless that is the case. And so the joy part is self-created. You can't pray to get joy. It's a contradiction in terms. favor us. Now, can we experience in some vicarious way the joy of others? Yeah, a little bit, actually, it is possible, provided you're doing something that is co-creative with them. It may not be as creative as they're doing, and therefore you're not going to have the same kind of joy, but you can actually participate in things like that. That's part of doing group service. It actually does work, and I recommend it. And there's groups called group service, groups that serve other groups that are serving more than they are. That's a good thing, too. Those are really important examples for how joy can be developed in a person's life. All right. What about the question, then, of science? Now, we have, thus far, I've been trying to balance tonight with some scientific principles. How does things like, how do we construct an understanding of Darwinian evolutionary standards? Which many people are against because they think that it removes God. It does not. But how do we bring to bear that understanding in our life and yet be able to, at the same time, recognize that we're not part of that system unless we choose to be, and then in that case we're being selfish and eventually evil. The way you do this is the following. You recognize lower levels of life and you give them their due by helping that life in sustaining itself and recognizing that all life is part of a bigger picture. And so it's important that people pay attention to and try to help all life. I will say this, but some people will not care for it. Therefore helps to become not necessarily a vegan, but definitely a, we'll call it vegetarian person, someone who doesn't eat anything that ever had a face on it. And so if you do it that way, and if you use that as an analogy, you can get closer to, we'll say, the animal kingdom. People that eat animals are continuously in denial aspect of what animals are here for. And it produces a lot of lies or untruthfulness in their minds about evolution and about other parts of life. You gain a greater respect for animal life, particularly, when you're not growing it or supporting the growth of it for the consumption by humans or other beings. So the thing that the important aspect of this is that it's okay to eat what animals produce as long as it never had consciousness in it. So you can eat milk and cheese, never had I don't really eat milk that never had consciousness. But it also depends on how the animal is treated. You want to try to. There's so many things to be involved in this. And even being concerned about it is not quite enough if you don't take some action. So there's a lot to be balancing in this area. It's not easy to do. Better to have organically grown, free-ranging, you know, that sort of stuff. And there's some products that are available to claim, at least, when they do that. You can look further into it and make sure it's true. The important part is to start at least with the spiritual part, which is God's thought, and being your thinking is right, and then trying to carry it through in actions that works for you. Now, some people may use some part of animals that are killed, both for food and for whatever other reason. Less denial there, but there could be some issues. Leather, people use leather. Well, the thing is, if you're going to eat animals already, somebody's already eating them, is that going to help them throw away their carcasses and throw away the skin? So at least it gives some meaning to what the animal is listed as. But The better thing would be that all animals are not raised to grow the way they are, so that they are free to evolve through forces in more natural ways that we mitigate or change to help animals to become more and more conscious, even if they can't yet be aware of their creator. This is an important change. And if we can do that, and then respectfully do that with all life, including plant life, then you've got an interesting paradigm that will permit people to recognize the existence of evolution and respect it, while also seeing that God is a major part of the whole picture, and that evolution allows God to create life that is fruit. And without it, it would all be determined and destroyed. Some kind of crazy big puppet show. Including animal life, all life would just be part of a puppet show. So you either have freedom or you don't. And it's like, well, I'll have a little here and I'll take a little there, but I don't want any more over there. Well, that doesn't work that way. Freedom is freedom. You got it. I really love it. Okay. What else can we do on an individual level, then, to improve our freedom? Education. This is the biggie. When we look at the present models of education, there are almost none of them. This includes Montessori, and she was a spiritual disciple, but her viewpoints have not been carried through very well in some of the Montessori schools that at least are in the United States. Maybe you go to Switzerland, it's a different story, I don't know. But the thing is that object is not just to be creative. It's to be creative in a way that's enlightening and virtuous, which means you have to be in the middle way or in the eye of God. And that's why it doesn't carry through and hasn't been supported strongly. Most of the schools that I have experienced that are Montessori-like, and also this includes some, you know, of these called private schools, you know, which are part of a new system in which people can pay to go to school through the government. In fact, those schools are still, unfortunately, many times anti-God. Some of them are really strongly anti-God, anti-religion, anti-God, anti-anything dealing with that concept. And so a concept of creativity without God is illogical and becomes forceful. So the creations become more and more forceful in the ways that they're both taught and learned. The schools are unsuccessful. To be successful, you need to have virtue or enlightenment is part of what is the outcome of creation. And it needs to be tied with wise giving and goodness and love, universal love, as part of the package so that you have spiritual thinking. And then you have the students doing things that are good for others in ways to help them to be the same, so not a bunch of souls. And that is a great school. I would say it's way beyond Montessori, and it's way beyond even some of the schools that claim to be teaching ageless wisdom. The reason is that we have become, here in the United States, in most Western countries, have become victims ourselves of what used to be a very godly kind of profession, teaching. Teachers are to have great respect, but a teacher, by definition, is supposed to be extremely open-minded, and to be teaching open-mindedness first before teaching information and facts and things that people are testing of. If they aren't teaching open-mindedness, and if they aren't teaching freedom of thought, and if they aren't teaching the ability to inquire and find truth and to be wise in the way that you use the truth you have, if those are the things that they're not teaching, they're not teachers. What are they? Well, they're purveyors of facts that sometimes, when joined together, become a non-spiritual method of knowledge. And you can test for that. You can quantify it. But it has little or no use to people in becoming more joyful, becoming more godlike, or in any way getting even closer to God. Every day you go through that practice, every day you're taught in that way, you move further away from your Creator. And you're moving further towards the animal kingdom. And evil, the door to evil opens more and more. Why is this going on? Well, because there's collectivism in teaching, we call them unions, that has promoted somewhat this. There is a need in political sense to have what is called numbers or objective results with money that is used from public sources. And that's why I believe all education should be kept very local, and the monies should be given to the parents to decide where it goes to, instead of given to quote-unquote public schools. This whole paradigm that we're doing is wrong, and it's mostly a Western civilization problem, but it's certainly part of the whole world at this point. Until we correct these things that are basically wrong with education, we're going to have it permeate the entire system, and the results are going to be poor as they are now. Yes, you can choose to find a school that's different from that, but you're going to have to look hard. And you may have to actually help them create one in some areas, unless you want to move. This is one of the more serious problems, because our young people are even more prone to be indoctrinated into darkness. It's easier because they don't have wisdom. Wisdom takes place usually in people after they're about 28 years old, it starts to develop. They're usually considered an adult in a spiritual sense. And so for a lot of them, during their formative years, when they're going to school, even if it's college, they're not getting wiser. They're not becoming more spiritual. They're becoming more dogmatic, more egotistical and arrogant, and more anti-God. It's a big problem. And this is true if they go to a religious school. It's not necessarily the answer, because religions aren't necessarily the answer to what I'm talking about anyway. They don't have to be wrong. Some religious schools could be open-minded and have a broad way of developing this. I think so. I don't know if everybody else would agree with me on that, because some people have rejected religious schools for the reason that we're talking about. I actually think that general public schools are bad or worse, especially if they're strongly affected by unionization, which most are. What's wrong with unions? Well, they see teaching as a business. There are some businesses where unions have been helpful. They've gained ways for employees to be treated in more humane and more, we'll say, uniformly virtuous ways. That's nothing wrong with that. But when you get to the realm of teaching, because it is such a spiritual job already, in a sense, if you treat it strictly based upon how many dollars and how many different kinds of perks you're getting out of the job, you know, oh, I got a retirement plan and I got this health care, and if that's the bottom line of teaching, then that's anti-spiritual, right? I mean, the reward in teaching is how much you get. Hey, I don't know. Certainly they're deserving of a salary which is commensurate with other parts of the society. But you get into this element in which it be- purpose of the job? That's a real issue. And then it's worsened by test scores to determine the level of knowledge, but with no consciousness or wisdom being measured. And certainly no element of givingness or lovingness, or whether the person is at all a creative being, a creative person. As long as you give the right answers on the test, you're great. You may be the most uncreative person in the world. That's a terrible thing. You may even be evil. That's okay, too, in the present system. All right. So that's the problem there. There's unionization. There's other issues. There's egotism. The belief that a person is right all the time is an enigma in a teaching position, because the ultimate goal is to get the student to become self-creative and self-thinking. And if that isn't the goal of the teacher, then they're not really a teacher. They're a dictator of knowledge. And it's my way or the highway. I know all. You will learn what I know, and you will think the way I think. And that's it. Whoa. Too much of that is going on. How much? Oh, it could be at least 1 out of 3 to half of all the teachers teaching. Depending upon the school system and that sort of thing. That's a huge number. My opinion is, those people should be doing something else. And the people who aren't teaching don't go into teaching sometimes because there are so many of the other kind of people doing that that they're continuously confronted when they want to help their students to be free thinkers, to be creative, to be sharing and helping each other, to be wise, and to be doing something with what they're taught in a way that helps the whole world. It has active elements and is interactive with others. And they're instead degraded for this, drummed out of the system. If they're not fired, they're made into, minimalized or prevented from doing what they think is the right way to teach. These are terrible, terrible times from the teaching side of things. Now, I don't want you to think it's the end of the world, but it's the beginning of the end of the world. It starts with this. Okay, so where do we want to get even more fundamental? Well, that goes then to the family. What's wrong with that part of our world, and how do we improve our family? Well, even if you're not a member of a, we'll call it nuclear family, you still can affect all families by improving the ability for the families that want to become more spiritual to become more, we'll call it, wise. The wise families are the families that, just as I said in schools, are free thinkers, that allow their children to think and to be co-creative with God, but at the same time, they don't tell their kids to just go out and do whatever the heck they want. They have rules that they use to help their children to learn to become wise. They are parents, not the friends of their kids. And they're interactive with their kids together and with others so that they all learn together how to become more wise givers and to be more loving beings and to be generally, out of illusion or less illusion than most families are functioning today. The illusion in families is mostly constructed from the general society, which today is moving more and more secular, is reducing the understanding of God, whether it's religious or otherwise. This is being drummed out of family life, and that is dangerous. When it reaches a certain, we'll say, critical mass, you are going to, we're going to have communism galore. We're going to have the Soviet Union as it used to be, and Red China and worse, North Korea as it is today, and possibly other places. Yes, it's going to move in that direction. Why? Because if the family, being the foundation, moves most of the elements of education, then you tie these two together and they become a toxic mix, leading to the ultimate generational destruction of the society. It only takes about two or three generations, and a country's gone, a, we'll call it, a philosophy is gone, all remnants of what used to be truth are gone. Two to three generations, that's it. 20 years is a generation, so we're talking 40 to 60 years, and it's bye-bye. Yep. And we are in the process here in the United States, and so it's most of Western Europe in the same predicament, that we're doing this right now. Now, what are some of the symptoms of this? Well, part of the symptoms deals with a lot of excitement in place, in happiness in place of joy, in bliss, a tremendous amount of materialism, exaggerated to the point where things are the operant aspect of life for young people. The reduction of things, replacing it with love, wisdom, and giving, and creation maybe of some things, but mostly of a goodness for other people's sakes, is the only operant way to deal with the, we'll call it, cancerous growth. And materialism represents, in the present way it is working, which is through defunct or failing families. I'm not talking about just where there's one parent or for some reason or whatever. I'm talking about where there's a lack of parental guidance, a lack of true sharing together in co-creation of virtue. Even if the parents are virtuous, if they don't get their siblings together, but their children to be co-creators with them, they are failing as parents. Children learn not what their parents are. Children learn what they live. I love that poem, by the way. And they don't learn what they're taught either. So what they live is what their parents live with them. And it's a real important lesson. You've got to bring in children into this, and it has to be done early. By the teenage years, if you haven't done it before that, for whatever reason, it's too late. I really believe that. You can't turn it around in time. You got to get it before, like, 13. 12 or 13 is the too late time. So be doing it when they're young. And then, even if you have bumps along the way when they're past 12 or 13, they can get through it. But if you wait and say, oh, I heard him today, I finally got what he said, but everybody 16, 17, 18, it's too late. You're not going to be able to change it around. It's almost impossible. There's too much against all of us in this. Our world is working against us. So if you haven't prepared much earlier, it's like really almost impossible. Yes, you still can do some remedial things. And if you really work at it, kind of in a crash way, maybe you'll succeed. You got to really be wise if you have waited that long. And it's going to be tough as all heck. A lot of resistances. Be very careful about the schools, particularly if you're paying for them, that your children and or young adults go to. I mean really careful. There's only a few out of the vast number, that even promote any level of open-mindedness. Only a few. Most have very egotistical teachers, especially as you move into more advanced levels of education. That's the scary part. All right. So, if the family is the basis of all this, and we can all work through our families, what if you don't have a family? Well, you can help people who do. There is nothing preventing anyone from making themselves available to help people who are having any kind of parental issues or problems. Especially if you're wise enough to do it, then do it. Now, if you have a greater calling where you're teaching huge numbers of people or families, fine, that's okay. But if you can't, then select some few to be of service. Create at the level you're most able to respond to. Your level may not be that great right now. That's the level you stick with until you can find a bigger middle way. Continue with this and God will grow in you. And so will the ways that you are being creative. But the idea that, well, it's somebody else's family, I can't be involved, is nonsense. We are all involved. This is not a problem for an individual family. It is a problem for all of us. The dilemmas are so serious, and the problems are so great. We need to be changing the situation as it is at the present time. And remember, the truth is the most potent weapon we have against all the darkness that is around us. But that truth has to wisely be given to us. We can't just stand on the soapbox and tell the truth. You can't. It won't work. Remember I mentioned Glenn Beck? Well, one of the things I found with Glenn was that he was doing just that. I mean, you got to do a bit more than that. You got to also present things in ways in which you're not constantly droning about a problem. You got to come up with some direct solutions and talk about them in ways that are more open-minded with less, we'll say, recrimination and with greater levels of joy and include a balance in that. When the joy leaves, too many people turn you off, and they consider what you're saying too negative and not getting to any real solution. I didn't know where people thought that way. And, you know, the funny thing is the guy actually had a better way of doing it before he reached a higher level of success. As we succeed, sometimes we lose our way. And I say success meaning more viewers, people who are tuning in. Okay, so here's where we go. If we're going to all participate together in some of the ideas of tonight's show and find the middle way, be part of God's mind, we need to prepare the things that are wrong within us. And so that does take some what is called reflection and then contemplation of how you're going to change. So my suggestion is, like, for the next week, so next week's show, maybe. Of course, you could go listen to a lot of shows that I've done. I'm like 9.5 years almost. I've been doing this. First year wasn't really great. You can almost ignore most of those shows. But anyway, I got better towards the end of the first year. The thing to remember is that you can assess yourself in a way in which some of the things I've talked about are your evaluation tools. And you say, well, how creative am I? Well, here's the point. If you can't think of the ways that you are or are not creative, then think of the ways that you're afraid. Because whatever you're afraid of is a blockage to creativity that should be taking place. Okay? So that will be helpful. I know a lot of people say, well, every time I try to think of ways to be more creative, I can't think of it. Well, what's really causing you to do that is your afraid. So try to imagine yourself in ways in which you're not as afraid, at least in your imagination, if not doing it immediately. And then go through it in your imagination and thought process, ways that you could be different. Think about your life as meeting the criteria of the middle way. And ask yourself, am I using all of my abilities? That's the next point. Now, most people use a fraction of their abilities at any particular time, again, because of fear. They believe that they're losing time and energy and using up resources that somehow they need for something else, which is usually selfish, and that they're fearful because they're insecure. And so they don't use most of their abilities for goodness, which means that most of their abilities are wasted and they don't have much joy in their life. Instead, they have a lot of sorrow and a canyon hole where there could be a great satisfaction and meaningfulness. Okay, and then also use that. How meaningful is your life? Go through every aspect of who you are and what you're doing and ask yourself, well, is that meaningful for me? If there seems to be a lack of meaning, that's another sign that you're not using your responsiveness correctly, not being responsible, and you're not being creative in a virtuous way, and you're not obviously in the middle way very much, or not nearly enough, and you could be more in the eye, God, and vice versa, and you could be co-creating a lot more. Those questions will lead you into that analysis and the ways to achieve the goal. Does that mean that it's a definite you're going to come up with an answer? Not necessarily, but I'm going to give you some other options. If you're really stuck, email me. Call me. There's ways of getting a hold of me. I will help. No charge. No, this is not a hook that I get to buy this or give me that or whatever. Nope. Help. Help is there. Or I'll help find other people to help me as well. I'll put you in touch with other people who can help you more directly in some time. Or I will directly help as well. How's that for a deal? All that for listening in? Yeah, that's the deal. Good deal. All right. And what if you say, well, yeah, but nobody can really help me because I got all these things that are wrong. The only way you can help me is give me this or that. Well, call me with that attitude and don't be surprised when I help you, but in ways that you will not immediately find pleasant. But I will help. Really. The thing is that what people want is oftentimes not anywhere near the middle way, not anywhere near being part of God's mind or anything to deal with, anything virtuous. People want many times the things that they subconsciously, personally, I call personality, have as desires and also as structures of belief about themselves, which have to do with closed-mindedness or egotism, and sometimes it's sense of arrogance as well, which really is tied to a lack of love with egotism. And then they also have maybe a litany of things that they want to have that are physical things because they bring some level of excitement. We talked about that earlier to them. Most of materiality, remember, possessions, remember I talked about the founders, is tied to excitement. Gee, if I just had a new blank, it would be exciting. For at least an hour. Things. Now, things that are used to create goodness for others are okay. There's no reason to have to be a pauper, running around in rags or some kind of crazy thing like that. That's not what I'm referring to. As a matter of fact, I think that when people are physically comfortable, there's an okay element in that because their ability to respond may actually significantly increase, and then they'll be more responsible. So discomfort they are spiritual because they're denying themselves all physical comforts, or most of them, is the antithesis of bringing meaning into your life and at the same time of being of service, spiritual service to others. Because your life becomes so miserable and your senses are so diminished and your ability to respond so much decreased that you have little time or ability to do anything other than to probably survive. That type of existence goes back to monastic factors and to wrongful religious beliefs, in my opinion, that were kind of thrust on people partly because there wasn't a lot of material things at some times, and so that people would accept that and go along with it without being rebellious or argumentative or want something else from the church folks that the church folks didn't want to share with or didn't have, possibly. This was a way of getting around it. Yeah, a life of piousness with no material goals, nothing, that's the right way. Okay, sleep on a bed of nails, whatever, and then you're going to be godly. Nope. That's not the way. Not the middle way. It's some ways that people believe in, and I hope I'm not making them too angry with me right now, but it isn't, you know, flogging yourself. No, these are all misnomers of antiquated, I hope, religious views that came from earlier ignorances of people who wanted to exercise authority and power over others. And the others bought into it. So the whole society kind of had a tinge of it for a while, a long while. Today it's more fringe. But it still happens. Okay. And what about self-condemnation? No good. Condemning yourself prevents you from being able to find adequate change. I'm not against people confessing. If you feel better because you told somebody of all the things you did wrong, thinking that God didn't know unless you said it, then that's okay. But that's nonsense in reality. The truth is that God only knows when you're creating virtue. And if you're not creating virtue, then you're not in the middle way. And so, you know, just confessing it isn't the answer. I realized that the original concept came from St. Augustine, the same guy I was talking about earlier, who catches the invented confession. And his thought process was different than the one that became executed. His thought process was that if I could just get people to talk about their things that they did wrong, their sins, and get them to get closer to the eye of God by doing good things, then everything would work. He thought confession was a way of getting there. It didn't work out because those that became the confessees, the ones who were hearing the confessors, I guess confessees would be the right word, I'm not sure, priests, of course. Those folks misinterpreted St. Augustine. Again, poor guy, misunderstood all over the place. And they thought it was the act of confessing that brought you closer to God, instead of it being the act of not only contrition, but of doing good deeds. And so instead they assigned rituals, like, say, so many Hail Marys, or count so many beads, or do this or that, focusing the person on a meaningless journey of nonsense. Instead, the answer would have been, okay, go volunteer here, go do that. What do you think you can do to be of service to others? And that would have been the right confessional. That would have been the true answer according to Augustine's own papa. But you know what? It just didn't get there. And partly because you'd be telling people to do things on their own, and it doesn't give the control to the mechanism these priests are working for, which we call the church, in this case the Catholic Church today. So, interestingly, you can see how these things, I'm not picking on Catholics, this whole system has been changed by many different religions in many crazy ways. The Protestants are just as goofy as many Catholics are in many different ways. And if you leave Christianity altogether, you find all Hinduism, you find strange things going on in Hinduism. There, they do believe you have connection with the gods. The problem with each god is each god is an extension, if you can understand this, of animalism with forces about which, in a weird way, gets you to see evil better. Connected to the desire or wish of the person to be favored in some way by that particular kind of god. Weird stuff. But that's part of what was developed to effectively have some effect on people into controlling them. The whole thing doesn't make sense, but it is part of that particular religion. So in every religion, there has been this desire to control people from an external reality. Instead of getting them to seek inwardly, this, as I'm referring to it, reflection and contemplation, that we can all do for ourselves. If you want to go to a priest or some, you know, some great shaman or someone, fine. If that's what you think is going to help you, that's okay. But keep your mind in a place where you are still autonomous, where you still can be the creative being you are, and you can co-create to find the I. Because when you do that, once you do it, and you can do it with this control aspect, you are well on the path to being a great spiritual person. Your life will dramatically change. Your life will become something of such greatness that you will look back and say, how in the heck did I ever do all those little nonsense things? Why did I do it? Why was this so important to me? Well, because of fears, usually connected to the fear of death, right? And then also because of confusion, because of illusion, because we all think that someone or something knows better than us, particularly when they tell us they do. Which is really the foundation of egotism, unfortunately, right? So it's a part of what is unfortunately epidemic. But we can get out of it. Contemplation, yes. Contemplation. See yourself in some future way, responding in ways that are more virtuous, more enlightening, to helping serve others, helping them become more soul-like through your own actions. That's a big deal. Why do we need to contemplate? Because we are so subconscious while we're physically alive, particularly. We are too much controlled by it, and we have to prepare for the moment or we fail. And I don't care how good you are. Without proper reflection and contemplation, you will fail more often than you'll succeed. So we prepare because we know, I know this is coming, and I just thought about this yesterday, and now I know the better way of responding. And when you do that, you just put a big smile on your face, and suddenly you're the creator. And you know you got it right. Yep, you don't have to be tested. You don't have to get a grade. You don't have to be told by somebody else how to do it or that you did a good job. You get it. There's self-reward, there's self-fulfillment, and the meaning of life jumps tremendously. It really does. All right. So we've got just a few minutes left here. Let me just go through some of the last things that I wanted to cover for today. If God itself has an eye, which is what I'm saying, that we both can look at each other through, then we, as people, have a lower correspondence with our soul about that. And This is true. I've already mentioned it earlier in the show. That I, with our soul, is the operant value that we're attempting to get others to also find. It shouldn't be so much about how much we find the I with our soul, as much as how much we help others to do that. I have been stressing the first, because most people perceive it from that perspective until they're doing it for a while. But eventually, my suggestion is that everything I've said so far be reconverted into a, which is a big challenge, into a way of seeing it only from the perspective of how much am I helping others to do the same. And forget about myself. Why do you become self-forgetful? Why is that such a good place to be? Because you develop humility. And in humility, we become living souls here. Humility is not only self-forgetfulness, it also is the open-mindedness of the soul itself, where it sees all ideas, all people's thoughts, as having a relevance of importance because we're there to at least help them think better. Even if we think they might be wrong, we assume for the moment they're right in helping them to think better. And in their discovery of a better way of thinking, we also will determine their own level of truth. And it doesn't help us to assume other people are wrong. It helps us to assume that other people could be more right if we just help them to think better, if we just help them to feel less selfish and more loving, if we just help them to be more cooperative in sharing the physical world of things and to use their energies in ways that helps others to become more efficient. So everyone's using less time and energy in wasteful ways. This should be the ultimate goal of everything I'm talking about in terms of living life. Yes, there's the interim time of reflection of self and trying to develop a higher self aspect and all these other things, but in the long run, it's the service studies. Focus ultimately on that goal, and the rest of your life will become the most meaningful life you have or could ever have. You become much more a truly spiritual person because you become a soul. Now, becoming a soul in the physical world still has to be balanced with the forces and issues that souls normally cannot deal with. So do not think that you can become literally all that a soul is and give up being a human being, because the human parts allows us to survive in the physical world with a soul cannot. The soul is totally unable to deal with physical or astral or lower mental forces, cannot do so. It's unequipped in its structure. The human structure is designed to deal with those things while it's simultaneously becoming its soul. It's a miracle that that could be done. And again, we didn't create that miracle. We're participating in it. That miracle was created by beings, great beings, the monad, if you know anything about what that is, and a solar angel assisting our very limited beginning part soul. Because our soul is really at the beginning of all of this. It isn't at the end. And we are a part of it. We must learn to do two things at the same time that are almost opposite at times. We have to deal with forces in three lower worlds that are very, very difficult and destructive, and including evil that uses these forces. And then we have to, at the same time, become soul-like, where we are self-forgetful and willing to even allow some of these forces to sometimes be destructive to ourselves for the betterment of others, while we don't let others become selfish and just give to them wantonly, and we are only helping them to become wiser givers themselves and become more spiritual and more soul-like. It's so big, it boggles us, because we can't we can't just be one way or the other. We have to balance all this. Again, it's part of that middle way. And become something so unique that it makes the human kingdom the very crux of what we could call the central aspect of life development. No, human beings are not the greatest beings. But human beings are the most important in terms of the progression of life. If you eliminate humanity, all life eventually ceases. That is weird. So we have an important role to play in this dualistic element of being soul-like while we are in forces that souls cannot deal with. We have to do both at the same time, and they are almost exact opposites of each other, without becoming evil, without becoming frustrated by the situation, and without losing the meaning of existence and joy in life. That's why it's been such a long road. And that's why it's so hard. And that's why you can't do it in one lifetime. But for some people, they want to believe you can, so they don't believe in reincarnation. But that's okay. Hey, you know, they'll find out as soon as they're dead, honestly. But you don't immediately come back, of course, and spending a lifetime going through other dimensions and developing a better part of the parts that part of sense is in. But regardless, we will get it right. You will get it right eventually. It may not be perfect because we're never going to be perfect. It will never be perfect, but it will improve. And in this life, you can get to the point where you can actually get quite a bit of joy and maybe a little bit of bliss as a human being. And you can reach a point of very high levels of meaning in life. I encourage you to try everything I've talked about in tonight's show, and maybe a bit more. Read some parts of Life's Hidden Meaning if you can. And also, some of the other things that I've written, and many other people have. That all helps to round out the package and so that you really have more basis, more, we'll say, parts that you can pull out in a tight spot where the forces are getting too great. Or, worse, maybe, you're running away from them and in fear. That, in either case, you can overcome that problem by better understanding, better consciousness, which does come from some levels of education and metaphysics and spirituality and religions. But also be, we'll say, persistent, willing to sacrifice, if necessary, some things for the overall goal of really becoming a living soul here, in a sense, but greater than the soul in some other way. It's an amazing thing. Everybody says, well, I want to be a living soul. Actually, really want to be a human being and a living soul. A truly amazing and remarkable achievement. It can be done. It's grueling. But eventually, we're all going to make it. Even the evil ones eventually come out of their little crazy place. It may take a very long time. But eventually, they'll get it. Well, I hope this has made some sense, and I hope that tonight's show has finally, we'll say, revealed some elements of God's mind in the middle way or the eye of God. And has answered certain questions that people generally have about those kinds of, we'll say, phrases, oftentimes misunderstood. Well, until next week, this has been Niles McClellan for My Life Here.